Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class at Crossover Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, from June 20th, 2017. My Dhamma talk on our Sangha discussion is the fourth of four classes on the wisdom of developing restraint. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at crossovermeditation.com. Thank you. Peace. So tonight is the last of four talks on the wisdom of restraint. This really is a key teaching and a key understanding of the Buddha's Dhamma. We create identities about ourselves by joining with the outside world through things that we like or dislike. And we do that in a constant way. And because of the way that we do it, our lives become a very distraction from living our lives and being present of what's occurring moment by moment. And it's at that point of contact with the world, when something is coming through our senses, that we learn to practice restraint. These identities that we create about ourselves seems like all that we are, because we establish that view in our own minds that I am what I like, I'm what I don't like, I'm what I see myself as, but also what we see ourselves as not. And a good example of that would be politics. You know, if we're a Democrat, we're a Democrat. Republicans are all crazy. If we're Republicans, it's Democrats. And we do that. That's just a good, you know, a topical example. But we do that with everything that we join with. And there's an aspect, the reason why I'm bringing up that political thing, not to get everybody riled up, or riled up enough in this country, is to point out that the things that we're not create just as much of an identity for ourselves and just as much tension as what we say we are, what we use to identify ourselves with. And there's nothing right or wrong about that. It's important to not look at this thing as a moral teaching, although it has moral implications. I hope I'm not getting too theoretical. The reason why I say that is that if the more we practice restraint in general, the more peace there is in the world. And it can truly be said that every conflict that we have had in this world is because of a lack of restraint. And so I've lived long enough to live through quite a lot of unrestrained violence. That's not to say that if you were born in the last 10 years, if you were born in the last 10 days, you've been exposed to a lot of unrestrained violence. When the Buddha set out to understand the nature of suffering, he was looking at it in all its subtle aspects, but also in its most exaggerated aspects. The situation during the Buddha's time was very, very similar to what we're living in the world today. There was a lot of competitiveness. There was a lot of violence. Northern India was the political climate was that there was a bunch of little kingdoms, and all these kingdoms were always fighting with each other. It was really a microcosm of the way the world is today. They had a lot of underlying superstitious beliefs that drove that lack of restraint, just like we do today. So again, the reason why I'm saying all that is the teachings are just as applicable today as they were then. The reason why the Buddha came to the understanding that he did is because the world was the same. I won't get into Nagara Sutta. We touched on that on our retreat, and the Loka Sutta. Both of those suttas, the names refer to the world. And in both of those suttas, the Buddha talks about the world being aflame during his awakening. The beginning of the Nagara Sutta begins with the Buddha sitting in meditation and then giving the picture that's drawn as he's looking out on the world, and he's saying, the world is aflame. And he gets into the whole process of how the world is aflame. The world's aflame today, isn't it? With the same problems. I'm not trying to bring our class down, you know, but the same problems are there today. And it has to do with the lack of restraint. Now, as individual human beings, we can't do anything with the restraint of other people. We can create identities and say that my view, if people would just listen to me and take my view, then everybody would practice restraint. But there's a lack of restraint in that. The only restraint we can develop is self-restraint. Restraint at our senses. What are the things that are giving rise to passion? Those of us that are on retreat will remember the fire discourse where the Buddha's teaching that group about how their passions give rise to all the suffering in their lives. The same is true for us. Practice restraint. Okay, so that's enough of a background. The sutta is called the Kuma Sutta, the tortoise. In the Kuma Sutta, the Buddha uses metaphor to teach the importance of restraint in thought, word, and deed. The Buddha's words. Once there was a tortoise foraging for food. A jackal was also foraging nearby. The tortoise noticed the jackal and withdrew into its shell. The jackal also noticed the tortoise and went to the tortoise, hovering around and thinking, as soon as the tortoise comes out of its shell, I'll eat it. The tortoise remained in its protective shell, and the jackal eventually lost interest and looked elsewhere for a meal. Just as a jackal hovers around hoping for a meal, Mara is the metaphor that's used throughout the Pali Canon for an agitated mind state that's rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Right? Everybody remembers that. Joe, I know this is a little bit out of context. There's a lot of metaphor in the Buddha's teachings, and that's what Mara means. It's just metaphor for a disturbed quality of mind. Mara hovers continuously, hoping to create confusion, delusion, and disappointment by contact with the eye or the ear or the nose or the tongue or the body or through the intellect. Remember how we've talked about contact through the sixth sense base. That's what the Buddha's referring to. And that Mara is a view of the world that's rooted in ignorance, lacking understanding of Four Noble Truths. So anything that is perceived from that point of view is itself going to be rooted in ignorance. Right? Unless there's restraint. On seeing form with the eye, or hearing a sound with the ear, or smelling an aroma with the nose, or tasting a flavor with the tongue, or a tactile sensation with the body, if you have no restraint at these senses, unskillful qualities such as greed, aversion, or deluded thinking will arise, and suffering will follow. Guard the senses with restraint. Do not crave for or cling to any thought or idea or mental fabrication without restraint. If you have no restraint with regard to thoughts, ideas, or mental fabrications, unskillful qualities such as greed, aversion, or deluded thinking will arise, and suffering will follow. Guard the senses with restraint. Guard your thinking with restraint. When you abide with a sixth sense base well guarded, Mara, meaning confusion, delusion, and disappointment, has no opportunity for further distraction and will lose interest just as a jackal lost interest with a tortoise. Like a tortoise well protected in its shell, a wise disciple, restrained, independent, harmless to all, free from ill will, is totally unbound. Remember how the Buddha described an awakened human being as unbound or released from clinging, not attaching itself or joined with anything through the outside world through contact with the senses. So this isn't to, that's the end of the sutta, by the way. This isn't to imply in any way that our senses are bad or hurtful. It's what we do with them. It's when we start attaching ourselves and creating identity through sensory contact. I like this, I don't like that. Or I don't like this situation because it goes against an already held belief. We're starting to create more confusion, more disappointment, more suffering, and ongoing distraction. But if at that point of contact, if we have enough concentration, remember the purpose of meditation is to deepen concentration. If we have enough concentration and we have the right framework, the Eightfold Path, in which to see things as they occur, meaning right view, then we'll cease creating identities, we'll cease creating self-referential experiences, and remain at peace and content with what's occurring in our lives. And that's the whole point of restraint. It's the whole point of recognizing when we're joining with the outside world in that way, rather than being mindfully present with life as life occurs. And in that way, this is just to tie it in a little bit with Saturday's talk, but in that way, when we're mindful of our six senses, when we're mindful of the sense gates, we're able to be mindful of the arising and the passing away of everything. In our meditation practice, when we're mindful of our breath, deepening our concentration in that manner, that simple process of being mindful of the in-breath and the out-breath is being mindful of the arising and the passing away of all things. And if we recognize that all things are impermanent, remember the saying from Lao Tzu, when we recognize the impermanence of all things, we'll let go of everything. When we recognize the arising and the passing away of all things, why attach to anything? And it's at that point of contact that we need to be most mindful and most well concentrated. So that's the end of the talk today. Any questions related to this talk tonight or the series that we've just gone through? Nope. So I'd like to hear what you have to say. Ron, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you. I'm going to restrain myself from talking too much. It's been a good series to contemplate all time and the restraint at the sense gates has been really important for me in the last few months. So it's good to have that reinforced here. And it's something that you can apply every second of the day.
Yeah.
And the outcome is always good. If you can restrain yourself from going after something, the result is always a more peaceful one.
Yep.
Can you turn the air conditioning off?
Sure.
Thanks. Okay, here it
is. Thank you, Rami. I know I said it earlier, every difficulty that the world has ever had is from a lack of restraint. Every difficulty that I've ever created for myself in my life was from a lack of restraint. You know, and sometimes it wasn't that, consequences weren't all that big of a deal, but sometimes it was pretty devastating. And it all comes back to a self-referential ego personality. Something that needs to continually establish itself in every thought that occurs. And if we can, the meditation method that we use addresses that directly. It interrupts that process. And if we can take that, and we can, off our cushion and bring it in a very practical way in our moment-by-moment life, our lives simply become much better. And the whole point of the Buddha's teachings is to develop a life of peace and contentment. There's nothing magical or mystical about that, except isn't that miraculous if we can, in a direct way, to develop lives of lasting peace and contentment in this lifetime. The whole point of it. Thank you. Anthony, good to see you tonight.
See you. Nice to be back in the Tuesday fold.
Yeah, it's good to see you.
I see Kevin and Lorna and Ron, but I haven't seen Helen and Mary and Liz here.
Liz, yes.
And Bonnie, so it's nice to be back.
It's good to have you back.
Even if it's temporary.
Yeah.
And impermanent. I appreciated this talk, and I think with what helps with restraint is empathy and unconditional positive regard.
Sure.
Because if you can unpackage most people and situations, you might not, unconditional positive regard doesn't mean you have to agree with them, but you can understand them. So
yeah.
I think that everybody has a point of view, and it's really easy to just label them as the enemies. But most people are not ill-intentioned. You know, they're operating from a place that, they think is best.
Yeah.
And if you can put that in perspective, I think it helps with the restraint.
Yeah. It absolutely does. No matter how hurtful someone might be acting, they're still acting in a way that they think is best.
Yeah.
Even though, we can go to extremes about how deluded some people can be and act in a certain way, but they believe that what they're doing is the right thing to do. And the more we can understand the nature of our own confused and deluded thinking, the more we can be truly empathetic with other people because we understand it directly. You know, that's where true compassion comes from, understanding the nature of your own suffering, and then you can understand it in others.
Yeah, and to realize that we're all connected, so ill will towards somebody else is really ill will towards you, and ill will towards, you know, and if you're acting out of ill will, it's ill will towards them. It spreads.
Yeah, that's the real practical teaching of the unity. We're united in our confusion and our deluded thinking and resulting suffering. That's where the connection comes between people. And then there's just a practical connection that, you know, we're all physical beings, you know. But there's an aspect of that the Buddha taught to notice the discreteness of all phenomena too, including individuals in that way. Glad you made it tonight. Kevin, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you, John. Good to see everybody. I haven't been keeping up with the series as much, but I would like to. This talk, though, did sort of feel a little bit of the metaphors pointing back to the four foundations of mindfulness a little bit, because you know, any time your mind or there's an agitated mind state, you know, it's important to think about that it's arising and it's passing away.
Yeah.
So I felt a little bit of that, you know, out of that metaphor. So appreciative of that, and looking forward to checking out the rest of the talks that go with it.
Yeah, they're up there. Good to see you again. Helen, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Thank you, John. Good to be here. I guess part of what came up for me was that sometimes we are impacted by someone else's non-restraint,
mm-hmm.
and how that affects us. And to kind of tag along with what Anthony was saying, what we always say here is, you know, to accept a less than peaceful mind state, and create a sort of layer of dispassion so as not to identify or, you know, even start labeling that other person.
Yeah.
No, there's no benefit to that. Because then that forms, that can form, I don't know, scenarios in your head about that person.
Yeah.
Or that action. So I think when you're confronted with that, just carry that dispassionate distance, and just be at peace with that.
Yeah, thank you for that. Once we start judging other people in some way, then we start going down that whole road of justification for why we're feeling that way, why we're judging that person. And when we can practice restraint, you mentioned be at peace with less than peaceful mind state. That's such a powerful way of practicing restraint, to not insist that this agitated mind state be any different than it is, because we understand the impermanent nature of all things. It'll pass. You know, it doesn't have to be any different than it is.
So I guess since, you know, politics is you know, is like the radio waves now.
Yeah.
It's as prevalent as radio waves. You know, within our family, we have different points of view, and some of us are more capable of discussing things without engaging in emotion, and some of us are not as good at it. So I had a conversation with my mother recently, and she was feeling the unfortunateness of it, because she feels like she can't talk to her grandchildren because she is of a different point of view, and it just raises the pitch.
Yeah.
And so it would be good to My youngest brother is phenomenal at being able to discuss politics in a fair and balanced way. We could all learn from him. But just to be able to take a breath and take a step back and be a little bit dispassionate about it and just let the person speak and not respond, not react to it, I think would probably help the climate.
Yeah, it would.
That would be good climate change.
Yeah, it's amazing how we have this thing called a constitution, and one of the hallmarks is free speech, and yet it seems like we can't let anybody have it.
Yeah,
you know, and you often hear me say, the Buddha described the first noble truth as there is dukkha. Dukkha occurs, and he explained what that is, and he could almost as accurately say as there is distraction. And politics today, worldwide, has become our most favorite distraction, more so than anything else that we have going out there. And in a way, you can say we've all really joined to the distraction of that. Good to see you. Mary, good to see you tonight.
Good to be here. The first time I heard, doesn't mean it's the first time I heard it, but the first time I heard it about restraint was last summer. And, you know, it hit me like, you know, in the forehead. It's a really good one in so many ways. Your output, it's just such a good series of sutras, restraint.
Yeah.
I felt like I was learning for the first time last summer, you know. Imagine being an adult with restraint. Where's this been? It was very impactful. So I'm enjoying this once again, and it covers all aspects of everything that Buddha taught. It really does. And I think restraint really helps me with the integration off the cushion. You know, I'm a doer, I'm an extrovert, you know, if I want to name myself things, right? So restraint doesn't, like, come naturally. So the choice of restraint and being present is, for me, the art of integration.
Yeah.
It's almost, does that make sense? It's almost like by doing nothing, by feeling compelled to do nothing in certain situations, is being a better version of
absolutely,
you know, whoever I am. You know,
it's actually another form of action.
Yeah,
skillful inaction, but
it's a learned, learned skill. So I really love this. I really enjoy it. I went on a really, really long hike with my husband this weekend, and I really thought, like, halfway through it, I mean, it was the longest I've ever been. The distance was the longest I've ever been. And more than halfway through, I was like, this is, like, the perfect thing, because we were walking at a good clip, so it wasn't like, oh, stop and view something. We're, like, falling for hours and hours. And, you know, you don't have time to think about anything. When you're starting a walk, you might still be thinking about this or that or processing, but after a while, you're not. You're just clear-headed. You're not thinking about anything. You're not. You're just totally clear. And, of course, you're out in nature and everything, so it's really, really nice. But you don't have to talk. You don't, you know, it's kind of the epitome of being nicely restrained. That was a great experience. But, love this sutta, and I feel like I've had good, practical, and skillful use of it off the cushion.
Thank you. I mean, this is, it's so important that we just went over four suttas that the Buddha taught 2,600 years ago on the same subject. And there's, you could really say that there's, restraint is part of every sutta he ever taught, to recognize it and practice it. He also said something interesting, too, that as an adult, you know, you're just realizing restraint. Most of us never even see it. We live in a world that the idea of restraint is contradictory to everything. It's like, what's wrong with you? Why would you want to practice restraint?
When you're in the room with someone who is practicing restraint, like, you know, some of us work in more of a corporate world versus another world, but like when you're in a corporate world and someone is in the room that would have what I would call executive presence, that person has restraint, is what they have. They're not trying to be the center of attention. They're not talking too much. They seem at peace, you know.
Yeah.
It's noticeable.
Think of every image we have of the Buddha.
Right.
It's almost always like that. You know, that is
awesome.
That is the
executive presence.
That is the,
something
that's
like
the
that.
First one problem.
The meditation pose.
Right.
Is the perfect example of restraint.
Right.
Hopefully you have it going on inside too.
Yes, of course. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank
Judy,
you.
Good to see you.
Hi there. Today was a day, it was very stressful, and I started out not using restraint in any way, shape, or form, and my husband, who is the natural Buddhist, tried to calm me down, said, we don't know if we have this particular problem yet. It was a big problem. I will check, and I will call you back. There is no need to panic. I will let you know. But I was completely panicked. I thought we had lost our health insurance. And, you know, in this country, if you lose your health, you know. We didn't pay it. I thought he was paying. He thought I was paying. Didn't get paid. And if we lose it, you know, it's a big deal. Anyway, I was completely freaky. I was starting to blame him and everything like that. So then I said, okay, I have to have restraint. I'm in the middle of an open workspace that's completely open. There's no cubicles. It's completely open. Everyone can see me freaking out. So I found the conference room, and I said, okay, I have to meditate. So I sat there for a few minutes and calmed myself down. And as soon as I was calm. As soon as I left the room, I was uncalm. But I tried to meditate again, and you know, it wasn't completely working, but I could calm myself down while I meditated. So, and then I tried to use restraint. When I spoke with my husband, I was calmer, and he told me everything was fine. I said, okay, that's fine. Didn't do any, but we just said, okay, good, now we have a system moving forward. I let it go, but it was hard for me initially.
Yeah, but you did. And
okay.
The end result of practicing restraint as well as you could was
yeah.
that the situation remained peaceful. Again, it's just a practical teaching on how to live our lives, and it works.
And there's not a lot of things that bring me into sheer panic, but that was like pushing that particular button is a big deal for me, not having. And so I just immediately went into a complete freak out mode. And so I tried to calm myself down.
Yeah. And you recognize that you had a less than peaceful mind state.
Yes. Less than peaceful mind state.
Thank you, Jim. Glad you're here. Joe, welcome to our Sangha. How was your meditation?
That was good, yeah.
You were able to maintain the method. You recognized you were caught up in your thoughts and came back to your breathing.
Yeah.
That's the basic practice. Again, there's more to meditation. We're developing a meditation practice and just meditating, and that's what our classes are for. So I hope you continue to join us and come up with Frank. If you're going to start on your own, start with short periods of meditation. And if you can do that twice a day for 2 or 3 or 4 minutes, and then be part of our Sangha, hopefully very soon you'll have a meditation practice that's very effective. And then you slowly integrate the rest of the teachings that go along with it. What I'm referring to is something called an Eightfold Path, which meditation is one part of, and there's 7 other factors that are to be developed. But Frank's probably talked a little bit about that too.
Kind of sort of.
Welcome to our Sangha, Joe. It's good to meet you. Frank, how you doing?
Good. Good to be here tonight.
Good to see you. Yeah, Judy, I'm going to turn it. Can we talk up? It's gotten kind of stuffy.
Yeah,
I think. Speak up, everyone.
I always enjoy the mindfulness suttas and the practice of mindfulness. It plays a huge part in my daily life. Practicing restraint within intimate relationships is probably my most difficult challenge. I'm more entangled in relationships, you know. restraint with food or restraint with wants and needs. I can see how right effort plays such a huge role in my life because of the hindrances that I feel every day. From wanting something to be different than what it is, or wanting something I don't have, or not wanting to lose something I do have, to anger that can quickly turn into hate or rage, worry or anxiety, or laziness, all the hindrances. I'm really mindful of how they play a role in my life, and for me, it's like trying to find an antidote to each one of them, more like desire and wanting things is like being more generous and having gratitude for things that I already have, trying to practice unconditional love when I'm feeling anger towards somebody, because once I form a judgment on somebody, I don't see that person anymore. All I see is my judgment. And so this method and practice of meditation and mindfulness is a blessing, but it's also bringing everything to life for me to see right there.
Yeah.
And anyway, I'm grateful.
I'm grateful you came tonight. Somehow you always say it better than I do, Frank.
That's why we say better than Frank.
Those strong emotions like anger, those really are such a huge distraction. And it's at that point where restraint really saves the day if we can. And that means that if we find ourselves even full of rage at the moment, if we can remember, like you said it, you don't see the other person when you're like that.
I try to catch it, right?
But you can.
Trigger point, and sometimes I miss it, and then I go too far down the road, and then I go right down that rabbit hole, and then it's almost, I just have to sit in the pain.
Yep.
And allow the tabs.
Yeah. Once you go that far,
it's like
hopefully you can.
And
you're going to feel the pain. It seems to be much easier to practice restraint over things rather than people. And the Buddha talked about that. The reason, I think about, this was a guy who was 26, living in his father's palace. And he said, not for me. And it was because of the entanglements that was a part of. He knew that he couldn't develop awakening the way he described awakening if he was that entangled in all the things that were going on in the palace grounds. And that's one of the reasons that when you maybe next week I'll do the Ratana Sutta again, taking true refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha is just that. It's practicing restraint from the world for even a short while. The Dhamma itself, the Eightfold Path, is a practice of restraint from the world. Coming here on a Tuesday night is a practice of restraint from the world. Every time that we sit, we're practicing restraint, even if it's just for a few minutes. And it has that powerful effect because we are disentangling ourselves from all those things that we are otherwise joined to from our life. And of course, we can't help but being part of the world. But the secret of practicing restraint is to not be joined with the world. So, thank you, Frank. Lorna, good to see you tonight.
To be here. We each tell us how we view restraint. Last week in the teaching, you spoke about the moment being all that it is. It's not anymore, it's not any less. It's just what it is. And I've kind of hung on to that a bit in my thoughts. And realized that week I've given it a name, that I mayo a moment. Like if you have a meal or a sandwich or something, if you just put that bit of mayo on it, it's just that little bit better. And that's how I go through the day.
Mayo the moment. The ninth factor of it is a mindful path now. Mayo the moment.
Driving the car, it's better.
If you're doing this, you're drinking coffee doing this, or having the TV on, or something. You know, there's always, you're always wanting something else to fill the moment, not just be content with the moment, but you wanted to make it better. And that's what I realise that I do. You know, instead of just accepting life as life occurs, which sounds so simple and sounds so beautiful and sounds so soft and you live like that and you've been great, you know, but it's hard to do. And as I say, I've sort of noticed that I sort of like try to dress the moment up, you know, in some way. I'm just not totally content with what's occurring. And so that's in a way, directly, you know, that it's a form of restraint not to do that, just to accept what is occurring in life and be content, and that's enough. And that is a form of restraint in that sense.
That is restraint. Thank you. That's what a beautiful explanation of it. To practice restraint at the mayo jar is the whole thing. The whole problem. The Buddha described the problem as anatta, the not self characteristic. What he's saying with that word is what you think you are is not it. Let go of those views. But then he described the result of that as five clinging aggregates. We're holding on to things that need to be more. And a self-referential ego personality can never be satisfied, no matter what occurs. No matter what is coming in through the senses at this moment. It's never satisfied. But if we can practice restraint, we begin immediately in that moment to diminish this anatta, this five clinging aggregates, the self-referential ego personality. And with continued practice, we can completely eliminate it. And then we are living lives of lasting peace and contentment, no matter what happens. And we're able to take great joy out of anything that occurs, rather than needing something to be more than it is, no matter what it is. And it could be a sunset. It could be a great sandwich. It could be a really good piece of chocolate cake. It could be the most a very interesting conversation we're having, but it's enough. It doesn't need to be any more. And if it's something that's unpleasant, we also don't go to not needing that unpleasantness to stop right now. And that's a foolish thing to do, because if it's occurring, it can't stop. That's what's occurring. But if you hang on for a few minutes or a few breaths, it'll stop. Everything will. And if we can understand that, remember the teachings on the three marks of existence. If we can understand the impermanent nature of all things, we'll cease needing anything to be any different. Because we know the chocolate cake is as impermanent as that argument with someone else. As it is with a cold. You know, when you have a cold, you feel like you're going to feel that way forever, don't you? But if you just remember, hang on, have some water and a few aspirins, go to bed, you'll feel better. You know, everything is impermanent.
But it's not that putting mayo on the sandwich is a bad thing. It's like depending on mayo for your happiness.
Yes. Yep.
Right? It's not like setting a beautiful table and adding more things, more flowers, is necessarily a bad thing. It's not being crushed if you don't have flowers.
That's right. Yeah. We don't need
you
to embellish anything.
Mayo and the flowers.
That's a sign to practice restraint. You know,
yeah.
I would say, nasturtiums are good with mayo. So. Thank you. Liz, good to see you. How are you?
Good to see you. Good to see everyone. It's good to be here. I always enjoy hearing what Frank has to say.
Me too.
I usually feel like what he said. Just add to that is, and along the same lines as what Frank was saying, was that once you start to integrate and embody the concept of restraint, it's the carrot, it's the thing that you know will prevent you from dipping back into that painfulness of not having that restraint, and the whole cycle of having to be gentle with yourself because now you're into a self-punishing kind of place of feeling bad, and the second arrow, and you're wallowing in, you know, why did I do that again? So if you can just kind of get it, and this is, I'm saying this out loud for myself, but if you can get into the practice of knowing how precious that, the value of the skillful use of restraint, how it prevents that, the pain that comes in that next moment, then I imagine it having a benefit for you on a cellular level.
Oh, sure.
Because you're not going into that sort of
stress.
The aftermath of...
And when you catch it in the sixth sense space, you know, you're catching it all the way over here versus...
You don't have to
That's
go
right.
anywhere near
yeah.
the idea of
right.
having to be gentle with yourself because now you're beating yourself up because you didn't use restraint in a situation when you shouldn't have.
It does have an effect at the cellular level. It diminishes stress. Again, the Buddha realized this 2,600 years ago. The problem is dukkha means stress in all its forms.
Yeah.
And it's only in the last 25 or 30 years that we realize that probably the biggest challenge for human health is stress. It is. You know, and if we can practice restraint, we're diminishing it. Again, just a practical way of applying this in our lives. Practice restraint.
So that's all I have.
Well, it was a lot. Thank you, Liz. Bonnie, how are you tonight? Good
yes,
to see
Bonnie.
You.
I'm just, I love the idea about practicing turtle. Kind of like turtle medicine.
Turtle medicine.
To have restraint. Not to react and respond so I really appreciated reading that today, and I'm going to have some opportunities this week to practice. So
isn't that a blessing?
Yes.
She doesn't believe it yet.
But because I am just a practitioner and not fully awake, I guess, as much as I'd like to be, you know, I hopefully can practice the kindness towards myself for having the feelings and not necessarily being able to have this, the kind of restraint that I might want to have. So, you know, thinking about turtle, it's like I just... things can roll off and bounce away, and maybe in that distance I can see if it's something that I really need to, you know, whether I don't need to attach to it and it won't define who I am. But, you know, to remember this in the moments when we're feeling like I need to, come on, I'll take out one foot at a time, down one foot, you know, I'll take it with my eyes closed.
I'll moderate you.
Wizard of Oz.
So just the concept of, I feel like I need to wear the turtle like a helmet or something.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you for that.
Thank you. Once we start recognizing the benefits of restraint, we won't have to practice restraint at practicing restraint. Because we realize what it really is, the keys to the kingdom. It's what we're after. But it so contradicts the way most of us have been conditioned to think. Remember how we started this four weeks ago? That saying that life is a banquet, don't leave the table hungry? That's the problem. You know, we think that we got to get it all. We're better off with nothing. At least, maybe a better way to say it, we're better off without being attached to anything. We can have everything. Just don't create an identity over it. Practice restraint at that point of creating an identity, of joining with something. When the Buddha described suffering, he describes it as joining with suffering in a way that implies joining with the world. Why? Because it goes right back to impermanence. we're creating a situation where our happiness, our contentment, is dependent on things that are inherently impermanent. And ultimately, it comes back to the views that we create. It's those views that are impermanent. When Kundana awakened, he said, all conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation. He was talking about the physical world, but mostly what he was talking about, or what most profoundly, was his own views of himself. Why hold on to views? Think about how we've described ourselves over our lifetimes. It's changing every minute. And if we can stop the description and the need to define who I am, then we can recognize that we're always in a constant process of becoming. And that's where the real meaning of life comes. What am I becoming this instant? Am I becoming awakened, or am I becoming more ignorant? Judy.
Yeah, I just had a very similar conversation this week with one of my friends who's recently retired. And she said, everything thinks it's so wonderful, but your identity is what you've done all your life, and then you don't have that. What do you do with the time? And I'm like, huh?
Yeah, it's
my
really...
My husband and I would both love to retire, because we don't... We might say, I'm a this or I'm a that, but... Our identity is not based upon our work. It may be based on what we're doing, but not what we call ourselves. And, you know, my sons and some of my friends said, what is John doing all day now that he's not working? I said, whatever he does with a true sense of accomplishment. Whether it's cleaning the house from top to bottom, or taking, helping my son with his resume, whatever it is, he is in that moment doing that thing, and that's enough for him. That's why I say he's a natural Buddha. And my friends keep asking, is he okay? Is he okay? They don't ask me if we have enough money. They're not asking that. They're asking me if he's okay. We did this last time he took some time off. I said, he's like a kitten candy shop. He's fine. And my friend couldn't understand that. She goes, what are you going to do when you retire? You can't just hike every day. I said, I'll do whatever I want.
Yeah, you can. You can hike every day.
Well, yeah, she couldn't imagine that being fulfilling.
Well, again,
terribly distracted.
That's right. Nobody, people that are that distracted can't imagine. Well, the first question that I get almost 100% of the time with people that are just starting to realize the implications of developing the Dhamma is, what happens when you let go of all these views? What happens to me? Don't I need to maintain these views to maintain me? And it feels like annihilation. If you practice restraint, even a little bit, you know, if I don't keep going for that second piece of cake, I won't have any of it. But the truth is, the great paradox of the Dhamma is, if we can, the more we practice restraint, the more we feel like we're fulfilled. I was going to say the more it feels like we have everything, we don't, but it's not. The more meaningful our life is, the more restrained we are. Mm-hmm. Because it's the lack of restraint that says that I need more and more and more, like Lorna was saying. You know, it's never enough. Whenever I give this talk, I can't help but think about this guy who owns a restaurant. I won't even say it's an area restaurant. He's a nice guy. But the minute you walk into his restaurant, you get this feeling that he can't wait for you to leave. It's like, eat your dinner, because he's always thinking it's the next customer who's going to really bring the big bucks in here. And it's just obvious how he is, and that's, I think, it is this gentleman. It's always the next thing, but that's how our own egos are. There was a time in my life where I got, well, I'll go back to when I was a kid. I was brought up in a middle class or upper middle class house with really loving parents and almost loving brothers and sisters. But it was, and I was given everything that any kid could want. And I was miserable. I was a 7-year-old miserable little kid. Because it was never going to be enough, no matter what, you know. And I kind of grew into that as an adult. And early in my life, I had... things were going pretty good. I had a great business and a lot of things, and there was a time in my life where I bought a new car every year, not because I needed it, because I could. And I still remember every time I drove off that lot with a brand new car, my first thought was, what am I getting next year? I couldn't even enjoy the car. But that's the nature of a self-referential ego self. It's never satisfied, no matter what it is. It's insatiable. But it's very easy to recognize it and diminish it to the point where it no longer affects our lives. And it's simply by practicing restraint, using the nomenclature of the Dhamma at the sixth sense gate, but simply at our senses, when we recognize that we're starting to join with the world, when we need more of something or less of something. Stop right there. Remember the Buddha's words, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not what I am. No matter what it is. Lorna, you had your hand up?
Yeah, which is what a friend of the podcast, going back to the Saturday teaching, the awesome Saturday teaching, watching things arise and watching things pass away. I realize I watch things arise and I never watch anything pass away. Because I think our society, you're always wanting the next best thing, like that guy in the restaurant, he's wanting the next best thing, the next best thing, the next best thing, and that's what I look for in life, is the next best thing. And since that Saturday teaching, I've realised that I never observe anything really passing away. It comes, and I don't, it's like, I'm missing the passing away of anything in my life because I'm always looking for something else.
Yep.
And that, I've noticed that, well, that's not a good thing, obviously. I'm not seeing the full cycle of anything.
Yep.
Because I see things arise and I get to the peak and then I drop it and look for another thing to arise to fulfill my ego, and then I kind of drop that, you know, and that's how I go through my, and I realized this week, I never watch the whole cycle of arise and passing away. I don't think I even conscious.
Well, but now you are.
Now I
you
am.
Know, that
yes,
the.
Am.
Do you have an example of what you mean by that?
Everything in the phenomenal world arises and passes away.
Okay. Yes. Okay. Right. You, okay.
The essence of mindfulness is.
Mayo.
You got
mayo.
Mayo.
You sit down, eat your breakfast, you have your coffee or whatever, and then it's what's the next thing.
Mm-hmm.
What is the next thing?
Mm-hmm.
I never. It's once it's over and done. It's what's the next thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the arising and passing away.
So it's like not being present. You're eating your breakfast and you're thinking, "What am I going to do afterwards?"
Yes.
You're never present for the whole cycle of life.
Exactly.
When the Buddha first described dukkha, one of the things that he pointed out initially is aging. And what is aging if we don't recognize the arising and the passing away of what's occurring in this moment?
Yeah.
We're aging.
Yeah.
The essence of mindfulness supported by concentration is recognizing the arising and the passing away of our breath. That's the initial foundation of mindfulness. When the Buddha taught mindfulness, that's how he taught it. He didn't teach it in any other way. Recognize the arising and the passing away of all phenomena, and we use our breath to do that. Because our breath is that metaphor for everything in the world. And if we can recognize it, and we can, we do it every time we meditate, if we can recognize it at that point, then we can apply it to everything else. And if we can recognize the arising and the passing away of everything, we don't even have to practice restraint anymore because we'll stop joining with things.
Wow.
We'll simply recognize we're in that cycle. But, Lorna, you bring up something that's so profound. If you're missing that, the passing away, you're missing half of your life.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because half of your life then is in the rearview mirror rather than having the experience of the passing
that's
away.
What I'm always saying. That's what that in our rearview mirror. I'm always
yeah.
saying that.
And that's what that guy at the restaurant, that's what we all do. I shouldn't keep putting him down. He comes to mind. So be present with the whole cycle of life, the arising and the passing away.
Yeah.
Practice restraint and you'll see it. You won't need the next thing to keep you distracted. Because you'll be fulfilled in this moment by being engaged in the whole cycle.
One problem in the society is that we're never given the time. We're not allowing ourselves, or we don't feel other people give us the time to.
It seems like that, Judy,
yeah.
But that's a what's that? What's
refreshing.
The word? That's a cop out.
Yeah.
If we feel like we're not getting the time, it's because we're not giving ourselves the time.
Yeah, we're thinking that we don't have the time.
Yep.
Yeah. And so, like,
one of the things, the practical benefits of meditation that many people tell me about, and I've experienced it myself many years ago, is by taking the time out of our day, starting with a few minutes and hopefully building up to 20 or maybe 30 minutes, it seems like we have much more time in our life. And in a very practical way we are, because we're not getting distracted into activities that are taking up our time. We're practicing restraint. It really is a completely holistic practice in that way. The more we practice restraint, the more we're not entangled in the world and other people's situations, the more at peace we are.
And probably the more agile we are to change. Like,
oh, yeah.
For example,
we're less rigid.
I'm not probably the only one going through this where, you know, the whole business world has changed. And it does, in fact, feel, to Judy's point, it does, in fact, feel like so much more is being thrown at us. We have to do so much more in less time. And
yeah.
It's all, I need it. And
yeah.
So, but you can't survive. You know, I mean, you can't even breathe in that kind of environment. So it's kind of up to each of us to figure out how we're going to pivot. And I'm going through,
mm-hmm.
I'm working for a company that's going through a huge organizational shift. So there's a lot changing, but you're right. You know, if you really take the time to, you know, what Lorna was saying about something full cycle, making sure you have the time to meditate, you know, like, even I have time now to exercise that I didn't used to make time for a year ago, right?
Yeah.
And now I do. And it is all right there in front of you. I'm kind of just having an aha moment.
Yeah.
Give me a minute. That's really profound right there. There's a lot of people that I work with that could use that kind of advice of, Yes, we have more thrown at us, but it's a cop-out if we don't stop and...
It's up to us. What's the second noble truth is craving for and clinging to,
right.
Creates all the suffering. That's individual. None of that is imposed on us.
Mm-hmm.
We get caught up in it, and it feels like we don't have any control.
Right.
But it's individual craving, and then clinging to that, whatever we're craving to,
mm-hmm.
joining with it. That creates all the suffering.
Right.
And where does that come from?
Fearfulness of how am I going to keep my job or how am I going to stay in my job at this pace, right? So all sorts of other thoughts come
yep.
into it that distract.
Because we're joined with that.
Trying to get back to just doing the work.
Yeah. That's right. And it all originates in ignorance. Ignorance of Four Noble Truths leads to all of that. That's where craving and clinging arises from. Frank, did you have your hand up?
I was just listening to the conversation, and I was having connections with it. And it requires a shift. It requires a shift in attitude.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that change, it's like that shift in attitude makes all the difference for me.
Yeah. Yeah. As that relates to the Eightfold Path, the shift is going from wrong view to right view.
Mm-hmm.
And another way of saying that is from an unrealistic view to a realistic view.
Well, that's what an
aha seeing things clearly.
Is, right?
Yeah.
Just shifting
yeah.
into right view.
And again, Frank probably describes it better than I do in a very
right.
simple way. But we're changing the way that we see ourselves in relation to the world.
Yeah.
That's again using the nomenclature of the Dhamma, the three marks of existence. We're recognizing the interplay that we have between this self-referential identity that we've created, the environment that it's created in, and there's the resulting suffering from that. Changing your view.
So
this
instead of saying, I can't do this, or how am I going to do this, say, well, what if I could? And then all of a sudden you've opened up the realm of possibilities.
Or you just do it without any real expectation that you'll be successful at it. You do it. If it needs to be done, you do it.
One foot in front of the other.
Yeah. And the other practical benefit of this, when we're well concentrated and have developed that refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path as a framework for our
mm-hmm.
life, we're simply going to be much more successful in a meaningful way. It doesn't necessarily mean we're going to become the wealthiest whatever in the world. We might, but we might not. It won't matter. You know.
Everything's easier when you're calm.
Yeah. That really is the key. And another thing that usually develops is we find that we can do with a lot less. We're not always looking to acquire things.
Right.
Why? Because most of that is based on an ego personality, showing the world, but showing yourself too. So, any other questions or comments about restraint? All right, I'll practice restraint.
We'll restrain ourselves.
And get over it. This was a great series. The Saturday class we're doing four on the four foundations of mindfulness, and that really is a very skillful series too. And all these talks will be online. Last Saturday's is online. I think I'm not quite sure, but I think next Tuesday we're going to start a series where we'll break down the Four Noble Truths in a series of talks, including what it means to awaken to each truth, and then we'll probably break down the Eightfold Path into its natural separations of the wisdom aspects, the virtuous aspects, and the concentration aspects. So maybe 4 or 5 weeks on that. Our picnic is coming up July 15th, rain date the 16th. The info is linked in the email and info on the website. Starts at 1 at Maura's house, which is just 2 minutes up Geigel Hill Road over the bridge, like behind Tinicum Park. So, and everybody's welcome, family, friends, pets. You know. Our retreat's coming up. Please join us. Sign up as soon as you can. Helps my logistics a lot. October 19th to 22nd. And I think that's it. Any other questions, comments? All right, we'll finish with metta, as we always do, and the Buddha's words on metta. So find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths. And again, take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body and let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future or that may have arisen from our talk tonight. And metta is both an aspiration for those, metta means goodwill or loving kindness, and it's both an aspiration for those of us developing the Eightfold Path, and it's an ongoing expression of an awakened, fully mature human being. And these are the Buddha's words on metta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace. Thank you for listening. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for guided meditations and instruction and Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos. We rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Please feel free to contact me through crossrivermeditation.com. Peace.